This is an ABC podcast.
Our lives take many unexpected turns, and sometimes strange symmetries appear over the course of a lifetime. How is it that something that happens in our early years, or even before we're born, can come to have enormous bearing on the life we lead or the way we tackle challenges later on? Caro Llewellyn is an author and a leading figure in the literary world. She's presented literature events in Sydney, London, Paris, and New York. But it was a childhood being raised by a father in a wheelchair that took on new meaning one day when she was out jogging in Central Park in 2008. Caro Llewellyn, welcome.
Hi, Hamish. Nice to be here.
How did your parents meet?
It's a very unusual story, and many of these stories are unusual. You kind of look back and you think, how on earth did that happen? But my father had been admitted to hospital. He had an attack of polio, and he was in an iron lung, and he'd been told that he would not survive very many more than a few days. And he did survive. And sometime into his time in the iron lung, about 6 months, my mother was a nurse, a trainee nurse, and you had to do a rotation into the infectious diseases ward. And there was my father lying in his metal contraption with his head sticking out on a little board. And she walked in and he looked at her and he thought, she looks nice and she looks game. And I think that was the amazing thing. He could see her in her something that was rebellious, and she was a rule breaker. And he thought, I think that this woman could be up for an adventure. And so he set about seducing her.
How old was he? What era are we talking?
So this is in the 1956, 57. And he was 20, by now he may have been 20, almost 21. So he was a young man. He'd been in the Navy. He was struck down mysteriously by an illness. He thought he would recover. And then one day he woke up and he was completely paralyzed. And he was rushed to hospital. And then his adventure happened, a big adventure. And he saw it as an adventure, weirdly. Most people would be terrified, but he actually saw it as an adventure. And he made a new life for himself.
What is an iron lung? What does it look like?
It really does look like a rocket. I always imagined it as a rocket, but it had a little chopping board, so it was round and it was on wheels, and it was I always say a chopping block, but it was a little wooden or metal headboard for your head to lie on, and you lay in there. I don't know. I asked my father once. I said, "Were you cold in there?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Did you have a blanket?" And that was the worst that I could think of, that he might have been cold. I didn't think about anything else. Didn't think about how terrified he might have been or how scary it would have been at 20, 21 to be told that you will never walk again and not even to be sure that you would get out of that iron lung. And he was in there for a year. And the principle is that there are billows inside and they contract and expand and mimic your lung movement and allow you to breathe. And then the idea is that eventually your lungs will regain their capacity and you'll be able to get out.
It sounds a bit like a coffin.
Oh, it is very much like a coffin. It looks like a coffin except your head's out of it. It's a little bit like an MRI machine, which I've been in, which is also just as scary. They're incredibly ugly machines they look like something out of, the Munsters or Frankenstein. He lay in that and they open them up. I don't know lots of technical things about, what happened with bathrooming or any of those things in an iron lung back in the day, because I'm sure I don't think they exist anymore, of course, but, they can't have been very sophisticated.
It must have been a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, I think so. I think there was a little bit of manoeuvring that had to go on.
So how do you woo someone from inside an iron lung?
Well, I guess you have to be very charming.
Okay.
Very, very, very charming. And I think he had amazing big blue eyes and he was charismatic. And he had decided early on in his time in that he thought, I've got two options. I can either be angry and bitter and just be a nightmare, or I can try and make the best of this. You have to in life. He'd grown up in a farm where there had been a tragedy with my grandfather. They were sheep farmers, and my grandfather made a mistake. He put barley and sheep together in an adjacent paddock. And everybody knows, anybody who's a farmer knows that you can't do that, because if the sheep get into the barley, they will die. But my grandfather thought he was a very good fencer, and he thought he could beat the odds, which he tried to do, and he was very successful until one night, actually, the sheep did bust into the paddock. And, of course, they woke up in the morning and about 150 sheep were laying over on their sides, blown up like little blow-up dolls. And that was a very big tragedy for my father's family. And my grandfather just took it in his stride and he said, well, now we make the best of it. He skinned every one of those sheep that he loved. He was one of those farmers who actually loved his flock. And he skinned every one of them. They sold the meat for pet meat, and they did something with all the skins. And my father remembered that lesson always, and he said, I just learned you have to make the most of bad situations. You just have to turn it around and try and turn it to your advantage. And so that's what he did when he found himself, when he woke up in the iron lung, and he thought, I've got two options. I can either be miserable and angry and nobody will want to be around me, or I can try and be charming.
What did this nurse bring him to cheer him up in the room?
I think she brought him a lot of things. I think my mother is a wonderful example of, she's incredibly positive, and she just looked at him and thought, I'm not going to treat him like he's a crippled or he's any different from anybody else. And so she's sassy and she was flirty, and she one day turned up with a big bunch of red roses. And she put them on, she went and found a vase and put them in the metal, you know, everything was metal back then. Hospitals were very ugly and anyway. So she was arranging these roses in a vase, and the matron came up to her, and the matron was a nightmare and she was an awful person. And she said, what are you doing with those roses? They're my roses, nurse. And my mother said, well... She said, I'm going to put you on detention. And I think my mother was regularly on detention in nursing because she didn't like rules. And if she thought that they were nonsense, she liked rules if they made sense, but if they didn't, if they were just bureaucratic, she would just break out of them. And she thought, he needs cheering up. So she brought in these roses, and then the matron says, I'm putting you on detention. And she says, but matron, these were in the hospital grounds. Surely they're public property. She wasn't fazed at all. My mother was not fazed, and she stood up to the matron time and time again on behalf of my father and other patients, and she just tried to make it a little bit more humane. You know, nurses back then weren't encouraged to talk to the patients. It was just about, you know, you care for the sick, you just leave them there and you leave them lying in their beds.
What did your mum, this nurse,
yes,
notice once things had gotten romantic?
Well, I think the great thing about being a nurse is that you have to, you know, you have to administer care. And I think they were always, you know, it was hard to write about this in the book because they were very shy about this. You know, they were very circumspect about it. But it was obvious that my father, weirdly, 95% of him doesn't work. His hands don't move very well. Well, when he was in the iron lung, nothing moved. But, you know, eventually he got some movement in his head and some movement in his hands. But there was miraculously something that did work that allowed him to go on and eventually have four children. So right. That was a good thing to know as a young woman.
There was some function there.
Yes.
There'd clearly been a bit of curiosity from your mother about that.
Well, I think, yes, I think they were both, you know, my father, they were both young, you know, just because he had this terrible thing afflict him, didn't mean he didn't have the same urges that every young man would have had. And I think he saw that this was a way that he could build a normal life. Back then, the options for people in my father's situation were you ended up in the home for incurables, which is what it was called, or you lived with your parents. And he decided... He loved his parents, but he didn't want to spend the rest of his life with them. And so he thought this was wonderful. And that makes it sound manipulative or that he wasn't, you know, he didn't fall in love. They fell in love, genuinely fell in love. And it's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful romantic love story. And everybody wonders, why am I such a stupid romantic? But when you grew up with a story like that, it's like it's got to be all or nothing. You know, it's got to be that kind of magic or nothing.
What was your dad's life like beforehand, as far as you know?
My father fell in love with the sea. He just loved the ocean and he wanted to have big adventures. He worked on the Adelaide Steamship Company for the Adelaide Steamship Company, hauling goods from one end of Australia to up the coast and back. Then he joined the Navy and he loved the Navy. My father, he was many generous things, but he was basically a cheapskate. And his favorite word was free. Fire sail was another favourite word of his, but free was great. And so the thing about the Navy, he loved the adventure of it. He loved being out in that wild wilderness. But I think he also loved the fact that he got his uniform for free. And, yeah, his favourite shop was the $2 shop.
He was a swashbuckling cheapskate.
Yeah, that's true. Generous in spirit.
How common was polio in the 1950s?
There had been an epidemic, and there was a terrifying epidemic that struck, you know, went through the world. And it afflicted, you know, young people, mainly young boys and girls. And then the wonderful thing of the vaccine came around in the 1950s. But they believed that polio was only, and it really did mainly affect young people, teenagers and younger. And so my father, by 1920, seemed to be out of the danger zone. So he wasn't administered the vaccine. So it was a kind of a double twist of fate that, you know, had he had the vaccine, he wouldn't have got polio. But it was a terrifying disease. You know, there are, you know, children weren't able to see one another. You know, school was stopped, sports games were stopped. And it just marched through communities because people didn't really understand how it was transmitted. And it just, when it hit a town, it was devastating. A lot of people, you know, recover from polio. Weirdly, it's not a hugely efficient disease. And it's quite many, many, many people won't know that they may feel sick, but they won't go on to have symptoms. Or many will recover from those symptoms. And, you know, I think at one point, my father, whether he knew he had polio, he'd caught the virus. He thought he had beaten it, and that was another twist in his story. But it wasn't hugely, for most people, it wasn't necessarily a devastating, life-threatening illness. But for my father, he got a very good dose of it.
When your dad first arrived at the hospital, there was a particular sequence of events that ultimately conspired against him. What happened?
I think sometimes these, you know, life just hits you, something happens, and then strange, small, insignificant things happen. And if enough of them happen, it can be devastating. And that's what happened in my father's case. You never know the truth of any of these things, but I know the truth of the facts, but the impact it had, I don't know that. But I believe it had a big impact, and he always did. So he was rushed into hospital. They realized that it had affected his lungs. He couldn't breathe, and they wanted to go and get. All the machines had been locked into a storeroom. Polio epidemic is over. All of this stuff has been parked because they think they're through the worst of it, and so it's not. You know, it's put into a storeroom. And the matron that had been on the night shift before, the previous night shift, had gone into the room for some reason, put the key in her pocket, gone home, forgot about the key. And so they're running around trying to get into the storeroom. The key can't be found. They call the matron and she refuses to bring the key back. She says, well, I finished my shift. I'm done. I'll see you tomorrow morning when my next shift starts.
It seems unthinkable.
It is unthinkable. And I've always wanted to meet that lovely matron and talk to her about those decisions. But anyway, she stuck to her guns. I don't know why nobody went round her house. I don't know why they didn't hatchet the door down, but they didn't. And so my father was kept alive by a roster of very, very diligent young women who, every time he lost consciousness, they prized open his eyes and shone a torch into it and just kept slapping his face around. And so he was like that for some hours, many hours, I think. And it was, he believed it was during that time of him not being properly treated and not having a ventilator and not being able to breathe properly and this just panicked kind of care. Was when the real damage was done to him. Now, who knows what would have happened had he got straight into an eye lung? I don't know, but it seemed a particularly cruel twist of fate that happened, that all of that just happened to happen on the day that he was admitted. What are the chances of that key not being in its spot? I'm sure it was in its spot every day, 364 days of that year. It would just happen to be that day that it wasn't.
Once he was through that critical phase, What was the prognosis?
The doctor came in. The doctor came in to do his rounds the next morning. My father, by now, was in the iron lung, and he turned to my grandparents. My grandparents were very matter-of-fact farming people, and they weren't very emotional. They weren't. They were very calm and steady people, and they just turned to them and said, "Don't get your hopes up." And they, I think the doctor really believed, they all believed that he would not last more than 24 hours or a couple of days at the most. And they didn't know my dad because he did survive.
What use did he have of his body?
Polio is a strange disease because when he came out of the iron lung, he eventually he got some movement in his hands and he got more in his head, but not very much. But he could feed himself and he could drink from a glass. And so he used to smoke cigarettes. He used to roll his own cigarettes. Really smart move for my, you know, to be smoking when you've got polio and your lungs don't really work very well. But, you know, that was then.
And the use of his hands, was that due to the nurses and their efforts?
Yes, they were very diligent. They had put, they had plastered a lot of his hands up because you get, if your hands stick into deformity, then you get you don't really gain that back. So they very diligently maneuvered his body every day on a very painful, Dad said it was very, very painful when they did that to him. And so, yes, he did regain some movement in his hands. But the thing about polio is that there then becomes a thing called post-polio syndrome, which many years later you lose function again. And so if you live long enough like my father did, you know, eventually he wasn't very good at feeding himself and he had to drink from a plastic cup that he held in his mouth and tipped his head back. But in the early days he could, yeah, roll his own cigarettes and write, yeah.
For all that you know of your dad's tenacity and determination, it must have been an incredibly daunting prospect lying there knowing that this was the future that lay ahead of him.
I think there were a couple of things going for him. If he felt that, he never showed that to me and nor to my brothers and sisters as far as I know. He really thought, his first thought when he woke up and was conscious enough to think about what was going on and to understand fully what was going on and what the implications for his life would be, he thought, why not me? Most people would think, why me? He thought, why not me? It's got to be someone. So here I am. And then he thought, this will be interesting. And so he was fascinated by what was happening with him. So he wasn't. And I think if you can be interested and you just take an interest in it, it takes away some of that panic.
You don't think he was ever scared?
Look, I think he must have been. I can't imagine that a young man, I can't imagine that he wouldn't, but he had a lot of time in that iron lung to think through his options and think about what was going to happen to him and come to terms with it. I often think about that. He was kind of in this meditation. He was on his own a lot of the time and it was just quiet time to think. And if he had fury, I think he probably worked through in that year. And he never said that to me. He always said to us, polio was the making of me. Polio was the best thing that happened to me. Seems weird, but that's really how I believe that that's how he felt, because he never in my entire life said anything other than that. He never said, I'm angry or I'm annoyed or I'm frustrated or he would get frustrated with his physical limitations, and frustrated by society and frustrated by society's unwillingness to bend to people's like his needs. But no, he was genuinely weirdly. And I used to ask him, I was just like, you're lying. I know you're lying. You have to be mad. Anyway, he always said he wasn't. So
after all that time in hospital, do you know how he went going home?
I think it was when he first got out of hospital, they said that he had to wait for a special wheelchair, and so that took some time for him to be made, specially custom made for him. And then he was sent home for a weekend, and he was very excited to be going home. One, just to get out of hospital, but two, he thought it would be time that he and my mother could spend quietly together. And anyway, of course, they delivered him home. They drove him in the ambulance to his parents' house and they didn't have a lifting machine to get him in and out of bed. So he just lay in bed all weekend and then got taken back to hospital the next day. And so he set his mind about, he thought that he had to be able to, he thought that if something didn't exist, then he would have to work out how to make it. So he invented a little very sweet lifting machine.
Amidst all of this, love flourished. How long until your parents got married?
I think it was about 3 years. I think it was about 3 years later.
And how did they look in the wedding photos?
Absolutely beautiful. My parents looked beautiful. I mean, the photos that, there are not many photos where you see my father's whole wheelchair, but the photos of them and the back of the car, and he's wearing a tuxedo and she looked beautiful. They were a very handsome couple. My parents were good looking people and they looked very, very, very joyous. And they really were. They lived their lives like nothing was wrong. They just went at it and they did, there was no stopping them.
What did your grandmother say to your mum on that day?
My grandmother wasn't quite as enthusiastic, and I think she saw what my mother was going to be in for in a way that my mother, I don't think, did, or didn't fully realise the implications of what that would mean for a life with a man who was that disabled. And she said to my mother, as she was just before my mother was about to walk down the aisle, my grandmother was tough. And she whispered into my mother's ear, "I'd be happier if you were marrying a dog." Happy wedding day, darling.
It's an awful thing to say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very tough thing to say. And I don't think it was that she didn't like my father. I just think that she knew that that would be an incredible burden on my mother, and an incredible burden on if they were, I don't know whether they knew they would be able to have children then, but an incredible, some kind of life that she was setting herself up for. And I'm not sure whether my grandmother thought that my mother was really would be strong enough to do that, you know, for the long term. And it was a miracle that my mother signed up for this. You know, a young woman, a beautiful young woman, she read English Vogue and she loved going to dances, and yet she was willing, you know, to see through this man's situation, to see that see the human being who was in that contraption. And he was a special person, and she saw that, and she was willing to, you know, give it a go.
They became a pretty remarkable team. How did they make a coin?
It began, so, well, my mum was nursing, obviously, and then Dad started by making placemats. And it was a very laborious process. He cut out, I don't know if you're probably too young, but back in the day they made calendars of, you know, watercolour calendars of buildings, you know, special buildings in Adelaide. And he would cut those out of he would convince my grandfather to let go. These were quite precious items to my grandfather. But anyway, Dad convinced him that he should be allowed to use them. He cut out the pictures, put them onto corkboard, varnished them, put felt on the back, and then my grandmother went out and sold them. So he started earning money that way. My grandparents gave them a loan. They bought a house that was a shop, and they ran a shop, and Dad could sit in the shop all day. And then they went on, they sold the shop eventually, and they went on and opened an art gallery.
What are your memories of having a dad in a wheelchair?
In a way, as a child, it was very special, and I was very lucky because it meant that I had a lot of time with my father in a way that other kids didn't. Other parents, other dads were going off to work and had jobs and, you know, busy lives, and my dad was just home all the time. So I had him all to myself, which was just magical. And despite his disability, I think as a kid, if you've grown up with that, you just don't see it. I never thought anything about anything until, I didn't even know what an iron lung was until I was in my mid-30s, when I just happened upon a picture and I thought, oh, that must have been what Dad was in when he talked about being in an iron lung. But I hadn't thought about it, and it was then that I asked him, "Were you cold?" You know, that was my question. So we didn't really think about it. They got on, my parents just lived life like there was no stopping them, and there was no, there were no
barriers.
Ifs or buts about it. They just, You just get on, make it the best of it, and don't complain.
Often as teenagers, though, you become very self-aware.
Did you guys experience that? Oh, yes. Teenagers was great. Teenagers, when I was a teenager, it was different. But as a kid, it was just life. But, when I went to high school, I was very self-conscious of it. And starting in a new school, I just wanted to be like everybody else. I was so excited to go to high school. And I just didn't want anybody to know about my father. And I'm ashamed of it now. I did some terrible things in trying to just pretend that, my family was normal and my father was normal, or he was just disappeared. I don't know, but I didn't want him around. Certainly didn't want anybody to see him. So that's, and that must have been awful for him that we were. I'm sure he could understand it, and he never made us feel bad about it. But that's a great shame of mine that I behaved like that. But I was a kid.
On ABC Radio, you're listening to Conversations with Hamish McDonald. Broadcast, podcast, and on the ABC Listen app.
Cara, in 2008, you were running in Central Park in New York. What was different about that particular run?
I had been feeling a strange, sometimes numbness, but also a heaviness in my right leg. And it was one of those things that you don't really think about, but it started to happen enough and over a long enough period of time that I was starting to get a little bit worried about it. But I just tried to put things out of my mind. And on this particular day, my leg was feeling quite strange. And I thought the best thing to do would be to go for a run, as you do. And so I did what I always did, and I got myself ready, ran out of my apartment. I was living in Harlem at the time, and I headed to Central Park, to the northern end of Central Park. And I started running up the northern end, and there was a hill, and I was used to that hill. But my legs were just feeling very, very odd. And by the time I got about halfway up the hill, it was really – I couldn't feel my legs at all. I felt like I was running on two prosthetic limbs so that my feet weren't actually touching the ground. And I was feeling quite panicked, but I just thought, you just have to keep going. I'm sure it'll pass, and I was just keeping up my father's positive spirit of it's going to be okay, and you just go through it, get through it. And I was really starting to feel panicked, and I just thought, you just have to believe that your feet are going to know what they're meant to do, and they're just going to keep landing where they're meant to do. And I was watching them, and I was, but less and less feeling as I went. And then I stopped. Eventually, I was just so perplexed about what was going on. I stopped, and I put my hands on my thighs, like you do when you run over a finish line in a marathon, with which I'd run many. And I turned my hands up, and they were completely wet. And it took me a moment to work out what had happened. And then I realized that what had happened was that I had peed my pants while I was running and couldn't even feel it on my legs. All I could see and feel it was on my hands. And it was the most terrifying thing that had ever happened. The fact that, one, that could happen. Two, that I couldn't feel it. And three, I just didn't understand what could possibly be going wrong. This was just all very, very, very confusing. I trampled. There had been a massive storm in New York, and tons of trees had been pulled over in the park, and it was kind of how my life was suddenly feeling at that point. And I trundled into the bushes, and I was so embarrassed and just so upset and confused and tried to pull myself together, and eventually did get myself back together and got myself home, and realized that my life was probably never going to be the same again. I didn't know what was happening, but I knew something terrible had happened.
Did you have any concept of what was going on? What was going through your mind?
I think it was just blind terror, because I had, at some point, when I had numbness in my legs early, maybe a month earlier, I Googled numbness in legs, and it had come up as multiple sclerosis. And I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. That's not me. That's not possible. I knew I had known somebody with MS from when I was much younger. And I remembered her as a slumped over person in a wheelchair who, you know, whose decline was incredibly fast. And I thought, there's no way that can be me. My father always said to me when we were growing up that he was our fall guy, that he had taken a karmic hit big enough for all of us and that we didn't have to worry about anything physical bad happening to us. We would, you know, we would have heartbreaks and boyfriends who dumped us and all of those things, but we didn't have to worry that there was going to be anything that would befall us like had befallen him. And he wasn't saying it out of any, you know, this is, you know, poor me or anything like that. It was just like, go off, live big lives, be, you know, be bold and you're safe. So there was, that was the added confusion in my head, because I was like, well, no, this couldn't be happening to me because my father said he was our fall guy. And so nothing is ever going to happen to me. So that was a real, real problem for me. I was just, this can't happen because he said it couldn't. And then, you know, just the sudden real, the very real understanding that something major was happening and I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was not good.
Do you feel alone?
Yes, I was very alone. I had made wonderful friends in New York and, but, you know, I was still new. I'd been there a couple of years. I was still new my family was here. I didn't even have words for, you know, describing what happened. I went to the doctor a couple of days later, or a day later. I rang the doctor the next day and I told him what had happened. He said, you better get up here straight away. And it was just a terrifying day of, right, you have to go and see a neurologist now. And they stuck pins in me. And then I had an MRI and I didn't do very well in the MRI. And the next morning I woke up and the phone rang and the doctor said to me, pack your bags. And I said, why? Why pack my bags? And he said, well, I'm admitting you to hospital. And I said, why? He said, you have multiple sclerosis. Get up here. So that was that was quite a day. And so I did what I was told. I packed my bag and I got myself up to Presbyterian Hospital in Washington Heights and rolled my little overnight bag in. And above the nurse's station on the ward that I was in, where they told me to go up to, it said stroke victims in huge writing. And I just thought, all right, here we go. And unlike my father, I didn't think this is interesting or why not me. I just thought, why me? And I couldn't get that out of my head. I just kept thinking, this is just so unfair. Not because it was happening to me, but because it was happening to me after I'd lived with my father and I'd gone through that with him. And that just seemed very unfair.
What was going through your mind as you were packing the bag? Did you call your son? Did you tell family?
No, I didn't. A friend drove me to the hospital and I must have told somebody I was going to hospital, but I don't really particularly remember that. But I didn't tell my family. I didn't know what was going on. And then very strangely, so I hadn't spoken to my son for a couple of weeks. And I had just put all of my belongings, I'd taken them out of my bag and I'd put them in my little metal, you know, awful little hospital side bed. And I was sitting on the bed and the phone rang and it was Jack, my son. And like I said, I hadn't spoken to him for a couple of weeks. And I pulled myself together and I said, hi, darling, in my most cheerful, upbeat, happy voice. And he said, what's happening? And I said, nothing's happening, darling. What do you mean? He said, something's happening. I know something's wrong. What's happening? And I said, darling, everything is fine. I'm just here. Everything is fine. And he said, stop lying to me. I know something is happening. And then I just start crying. And I said to him, it's all right. I'm in the hospital, but it's okay. And, you know, I'm sure it's nothing. And anyway, that was the beginning of that.
Were you in that moment trying to be your dad saying to the kid, there's no problem here?
Yeah. And I think what was most terrifying to me when I realized that something bad was happening, so the doctor eventually came in and he said to me, do you live in an apartment with stairs? And I knew exactly what that question meant. It meant that I'm going to be in a wheelchair and I should start thinking about, you know, living a very different kind of a life. And when he said that, well, I wanted to get out of that hospital bed, even though I couldn't feel my legs, and I wanted to king hit him across the ward, but I didn't. And all I could think about was, how am I going to have this conversation with Jack? How am I going to have that? I grew up with it. I didn't know any better. But Jack had seen his grandfather, and I thought, how am I going to tell him that he's going to have the same life that I had? And that was a very hard moment to come to terms with.
What had Jack called your dad when he was little?
When he was about two, Jack came in and he came into a very busy room when there was a party going on, and my father was sitting in his chair, and we were all sitting around in the sunroom at my father's house at Henley Beach. And Jack came in and said, "Chair, where's my train?" It was his Thomas the Tank Engine train. And he just kept saying, "Chair, where's my train?" And Dad didn't, of course, he didn't respond, because he was like, "Who's called Chair?" Until finally Jack just pulled on his trouser leg and said, "Chair." And my father said, What, Jack?" And he said, "Well, Chair, where is my train?" So Jack, the little two-year-old, decided to call the man was his chair. He was his wheelchair. And Jack just called it that. The whole room went silent. Once everybody knew what was going on, that this child was calling this man in a wheelchair chair, the whole place, just everybody looked down and they didn't know where to look or what to do. And, of course, my father started laughing. He thought it was hilarious. And it remained my father's favourite name, and we all called him Chair until he died. So it was beautiful. It was great, because he was his chair. He was his wheelchair. It was his personality. It was his persona. It was everything about him. But it took a two-year-old to say it.
That identity so closely linked with the physical apparatus. Was that what you were thinking about when you had to talk to Jack?
Yes, the idea of being in a wheelchair was just really not something that I ever pictured for my life, and I didn't have a partner. You know, I was a single person. I'd been a single mom, and I was single at this time, and I didn't want Jack to have to forego his life to look after me. And I would never guess. So that was a tricky thing. It's one thing if you're married and you have somebody who can, you know, a partner or a committed adult. I didn't want my, you know, I think he was, I can't remember how old he was, 19-year-old son having to look after me because there was nobody else, because, you know.
What did your brother say to you at this time?
My older brother Hugh, when he found out, he rang me, and he was in, my brother is very tough and, you know, not one for a lot of emotion, and he was crying, and he said to me, "We're cursed. We're cursed, first Dad and now you." And I wanted to say to him, "Well, we're not cursed. You're fine. I'm cursed. Dad was cursed, but you're not cursed." But I thought that was very mean-spirited, so I didn't say that. But I remember just thinking, no, it's not we, it's me. It's me and Dad, and this is, you're all going to be fine, and thank God they are. But yes, it just felt, and he also said, you know, he said, when he was trying to cheer me up, and he said, "But do you remember Dad always said that polio was the best thing that happened to him? So you will be all right, and we will get through this." And that was everybody's attitude.
How much do we know about MS?
Not a lot. Not a lot. There's a lot of money spent on research, and of course it's come a long way. And again, that is such good news. Even in the time I've had MS now for 10 years, which is hard to believe. It feels like no time in a lifetime. But the medication has so greatly improved. You know, when I started out, I was injecting myself every day with awful medicine that made me terribly sick. And, you know, it was quite brutal. Just the treatment was brutal. And they didn't even know whether it really worked. They didn't understand why it worked or how it worked. They don't really know what causes MS. There are theories about vitamin D and other things. But it's a very complex disease, and it affects everybody differently. They call it a snowflake disease because everyone is different. So there's no, you know, when I asked the neurologist what's my prognosis, they said, "Well, no telling, you know, you can't tell." So, and in some ways that's good, you know, because you have to live for now. But in other ways, it's sometimes, I think, probably comforting to know this is how this is going to play out, or this is, you know, this is what you can expect. But you just don't know.
What are some of the stranger things that people ask you about MS?
It's very funny because it's funny to me that people are very, you know, I walk with a walking stick and I have a limp and, you know, I'm sometimes not all put together and I can fall over at a drop of a hat. And it's quite amazing how people, you know, particularly when they get into a cab, what happened to your leg? What's wrong with you? You all right? And that's a very Australian thing to do. In America, that didn't happen so much. But, you know, here it's just very like, what's wrong with you? And sometimes I say, I've got MS, and then it's very funny to see people's reactions because then they don't know what to say because they realize that they've – anyway, and then sometimes I say, oh, you know, I had a running accident or I've hurt my knee. And then you have long conversations with people about their knee problems and their, you know, their surgery and you should go and see this particular doctor. And so, yeah, you can't really win with however you answer that question, but I'm becoming better at saying I've got MS. When I first was diagnosed, I couldn't say the words multiple sclerosis without completely falling apart.
What do you wish people would ask you about it?
I think that there is a lot of stigma around MS, and I think that if you Google MS, when I meet somebody and they want to know about what MS is like, I said, don't Google it. Ask me anything you want. I'll tell you everything I can. I'll be as honest as I can, but do not Google that shit because it's awful. And you can have these symptoms. Like people can, you know, I had that one incident in Central Park. Thankfully, that has never happened again. And that's the other thing. Things come and go. And so you feel like, all right, now I've got to get used to this. And then it goes away and you think, wow, that's great. And then something else happens. So it's a mysterious disease. And I could be like this for the rest of my life or tomorrow I could wake up and not be like this. And so you just have to live every single day. Like today's the day and today I'm here and today it's right here and it's right now.
So sitting here right now, can you describe for me, for us, how your legs feel?
I have all feeling back. So I lost feeling for about a year and then all of a sudden it came back. When I did have a boyfriend for a short amount of time and he'd put his hand on my leg, I wouldn't feel it at all. And I wouldn't say that, but I couldn't feel anything. And then all of a sudden, it just one day it's all back. I have trouble... So the what happens is the messaging from the brain. So my brain says pick your leg up, and that message, because the connective tissue through my spinal cord is disrupted, so the message doesn't get through. So it's a confused message. So my leg just doesn't know what it's meant to do, even though I'm saying pick up, you ridiculous thing, and walk like it looks so easy to walk. So I'm affected on my right side only, and mainly in my leg. I have a little weakness in my right hand, my right arm, but just mainly my leg. And I just walk with a bit of a hitch and a swing.
It must be remarkable to suddenly rediscover feeling in the leg, though.
Yes, it was great.
Did you rush out and get a massage?
No. But it was great. And that is a very good thing to have feeling back. It's a very unnerving thing not to, you know, I knew something was up because I was shaving my legs and I would cut myself and I wouldn't even feel it. And I thought, oh, this is so very strange. Anyway, yes. But thankfully that has all returned.
How important is it to have the right cane?
Oh, it's very important to have the right cane. I was a very reluctant cane getter until my business in New York. I was working with a wonderful woman called Jill, and she was very New York-y and very directive. And so one day she said to me, "You look like a drunk person. You look drunk all day. You're walking around. You look like a drunk. So we're going to go and buy you a cane." And I said, "No, there's no way. I'm not having a cane. We're not getting a cane." She said, "Yes, we are." She was very small but very determined. Anyway, next thing I know, I'm in the cane store and I go up and say, "I want one of those ugly, you know, just plain black, plastic, ridiculous, you know, hospital canes." And she says, "You are not getting one of those. You are getting something stylish. If you're going to have a cane, you're going to rock the cane." Anyway, so I got a semi-stylish cane and then I went back to the store the last time I was in New York and I bought a crazy Jaguar, a big cane with a Jaguar on it, and it's fabulous and I love it. So I think if you're going to have a cane, you've got to rock the cane.
It's a cane with attitude.
Yeah, that's right. Doesn't have a sword inside, though.
You mentioned there was a boyfriend. I know you've been on dating apps. How does this whole thing affect the dating life?
It's challenging. I did go on dating apps in New York, and it was just so soul-destroying.
I think that's the case for everyone, isn't it?
Yes, I think probably so. But at any rate, eventually the conversation would be, what happened to you? Like, and this was before I had a cane, so I was just limping. And then I would say, you know, I was a runner and I hurt. And then I would have more conversations about knee surgery and we're going to get you knee surgery. Anyway, so I decided to stop that. And it is challenging. It is challenging. But recently I have re-embarked on a romantic thing, and I fell over in front of him and he caught me, and then I thought, that's the end of that. There's no way that somebody wants to go out with somebody who falls over in the street randomly when you're walking around. But sometimes people don't care about that, which is nice.
When all of this happened, you were really at a high point in your career doing, you know, things on a global scale. What did it mean for you having this diagnosis?
Professionally, nothing. I made sure that it didn't. I just worked through it. And so that first festival after I was diagnosed. I got my definitive diagnosis in November, and for the two months before that, I was not in great headspace or physical space. And so at that point I was working with Salman Rushdie, and he was my boss, and I was running the Penn Festival in New York. And that was a very tough job. New York City is a hard job to do anything but a literary festival in New York, and was very challenging. And Salman said to me, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to go home? And I said, no, I don't want to go home. I want to keep working. And he said, all right. So we did. And I don't think that there was a single person at that festival who would have known anything was wrong. And I went on to, you know, I ran the New York Public Library Centennial Celebrations, which was an enormously challenging job for a year in terms of just the volume of and the pressure of a $1 million project to deliver in a very short amount of time. And then I went off and worked in France and set up a literary festival there. And I just won't let it stop me. And professionally, it takes some juggling sometimes, and I have to do some fancy footwork without the actual fancy footwork. But it just makes me more determined. I just think.
Did you wish your dad was around to talk to about all of this?
No, I was very glad that he was dead, because I thought that it would just break his heart. And I think he would have given me lots of very good advice, and I probably would have done better had he been alive. But I'm very glad for his sake that he wasn't, because he would have been furious on my behalf. It would have really annoyed him. But my family is wonderful, and I have lots of support from them. And I think the other day I arrived in Adelaide at Adelaide Airport, and my little sister was pushing me in a wheelchair, and I turned around and I said, isn't this weird? And she said, oh, yeah. And you know, we just adapt. So it's good, but I'm very glad that he wasn't here to see it.
It's been such a pleasure to meet you. Cara Llewellyn, thank you.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Cara Llewellyn. Cara's memoir is called Diving Into Glass. This conversation will be available as a podcast on our website shortly, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Hamish McDonald. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.